We did some readjustment of this microphone, so let me. Is the audio, is it good?
Yeah.
You can hear me? Good. Yeah, so we did kind of leave it at this little cliffhanger of when does the new covenant begin? And I actually think that that's actually a really good question. I don't even have that all figured out right now. I think it's more complicated than we might think it is, just based on looking at that one simple question. And I actually want to refer to a question that we see right at the start of the book of Acts. Basically, the disciples, after being instructed by Christ for many days on the kingdom, I think they're asking more or less the same question. They're saying, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" And he said to them, "It is not for you to know the times or seasons which the Father has put in his own authority." So, to put the link between these two things, we have to see that really the Testament, the New Testament, the New Covenant is intimately linked with the realization of the kingdom. And if we go into something like the Last Supper, where Christ announces this just before his death, he's talking about the blood of the new covenant. What does he say? "For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." So the main thing I want to highlight there is just the linkage between the blood of the covenant, which most definitely was shed on the cross, and he's speaking about that right there, the blood of the new covenant. But the fact that there's some distant future time when he's gonna partake of this communion again in the Father's kingdom, and I think that that future time signifies something of a completion, right? So the question is really, what's the unfolding of this to get to the end game? What does that actually look like? And maybe we should ask another question. What does a restored kingdom look like, right? What is that? Well, what we saw, there's land. That's confirmed by the will of Jehovah. There's people. That's confirmed by the will of Jehovah. But we also have to have Jehovah, the king and priest himself. We don't have the old priest system that was part of the law. We've got the new priest system, the priests and kings that are with Jehovah within this kingdom. And that's a special role, a special part of the people that are playing this leadership role in the new covenant restored kingdom. So the question is, how do we go from the cross to this picture? And the thing that I've been learning by actually like looking through and comparing the testaments is there's actually what I would call a kingdom pattern in our Bible. And I've chosen to slice it up these three ways. I'm not saying that's hard and fast. I'm not saying there's other ways there's definitely different ways we could label this. But I found, at least in the things that I was studying, these three steps have definite fulfillments and echoes in the Old Testament with Moses leading up to the Promised Land, as well as in the New Testament with Christ leading up to the millennium. So what I want to do, I might regret trying to pack this all into one study today, but we're going to like fly through this and cover a lot of ground, and I just want to pull out the high points for each of these three story arcs, and then we're going to come back around and wrap this up. But I think it's going to be interesting, so let's see where this goes. So what I'm really proposing is we take these three arcs and we actually compare the Old Testament to the New Testament. And I think that that's a scriptural approach to this, because if you think about the teaching that the disciples got, that question that they had in Acts, if we go back into Luke, and I think I had the verse here, it was in Luke 24, I didn't put it on my presentation, but what was Jesus' approach to teaching them? I just need to find the verse. It's like Luke 24, 44, something like this. Yeah, he was explaining to them all the things that must be fulfilled, which were written in the Law of Moses and the Prophets and in the Psalms concerning them. And he opened their understanding from the Scriptures. And there's a few other places that talk about that. But the key thing is, he started with the Law. He started with Moses. I think Moses is kind of like the Understanding Bible Prophecy 101 course, right? When we're trying to understand this, and particularly when we get into, say, the last part of this, which we'll see is Revelation, we're off in all these other prophets and Daniel, and that's great. We need those, but those are advanced courses. And quite honestly, I'm not qualified to teach those right now. So I'm just looking at the 101. What can I learn from Moses to help orient what's going on here? So at the end, I've kind of put the crown symbolizing this. We've got Israel inheriting the Promised Land, and this is our Old Testament or our Exodus track on the bottom. And we've got the millennium from Revelation lined up on the top track, which would be the New Testament. So what's going on in the Gospels? Well, the thing I just want to highlight is that we've got some preaching to Israel going on in the Gospels. And in one case, we have Moses teaching, and in another case, we have Christ teaching. A couple of interesting points that actually line up. So each one of these, both Moses and Jesus, they taught from a mountain. There was an event that involved the blood of the covenant, and there was actually an ascension into clouds. What does that look like? So if you remember what happened at Mount Sinai, there were actually, I don't know if it was maybe 6 or 7, Moses had a number of different trips up and down that mountain. I have not been able to like look at all of those, but this is one that happens just before the tablets are given. So Moses had had communication with God. He came down from the mountain, and then he told all the words of God to the people and the judgments of God. And just looking at, you know, we looked at the Sermon on the Mount yesterday, and in this case, Jesus sees the multitudes, he goes up into the mountain, and he preaches a sermon. So I just want to pull that out. Mountain preaching, that's interesting. Exodus 24, Matthew 5, more to read there. And then, what does Moses do after that? Well, he builds an altar, and he makes a sacrifice, and he says, this is the blood of the covenant. Now, which covenant is that? That's the old covenant, right? So that's the blood of the old covenant. He sprinkles some of the blood on the altar, and then the people actually acknowledge this covenant. They say basically everything that Jehovah says we will do, and Moses sprinkles the blood on the people. If we line this up to the track on the top, what happens in that storyline? Well, we saw already the Passover. Christ announces, this is my blood of the new covenant. We've got the blood of the covenant coming. But an interesting thing happens. It's almost like there's a negative fulfillment of this sprinkling, because when he's before Pilate, the blood doesn't get applied to the people the same way. In fact, they ask for a murder instead of Christ, and there's like this backwards application of the blood where they say, his blood be upon us, and they don't even know what they're doing. But, you know, the blood is going on the people there. And there's another little thing, that could be a whole other study, but I think there was also a sprinkling of that blood on an altar. That altar wasn't an earthly altar, though. And if you just drop into John 20, we're not going to go there right now. And if you want these slides after so you can look at all this, we'll figure out a way to get them over to you so you don't have to be like madly chasing these things. But when Jesus is seen by the women in the garden, he basically says, don't touch me because I haven't ascended to my Father yet. And I'm wondering if there's a scene here when we start to piece that together with Hebrews 9, where we learn about there's like a sprinkling that happens in a tabernacle and an altar that's not on earth. What's going on there? You know, I don't understand all that, but that's kind of interesting. A sprinkling of a blood in in a different kind of altar. And then what do we have as we continue down the Moses and the gospel storyline? Well, Moses and the elders then, they have a chance, they get called up, and they have a chance to actually see the God of Israel. That's a very interesting encounter to just read and go think about. And then Moses ascends into the mountain for 40 days. And of course, when he does that, he disappears into the clouds, right? They don't see him. He's just up there in the mountain. What happens, you know, right at the start of Acts, towards the end of the Gospels, we have, instead of Moses or instead of Jesus being in the mountain for 40 days, he's teaching and he's seen of those followers for 40 days. Then he ascends and then he disappears into the clouds. Kind of like Moses. Very interesting. So, now, Moses is up in the mountain. Christ is in the mountain, quote unquote. He's ascended into the clouds, into heaven. What's this next chapter that's going to play out in this kingdom pattern? Well, this is actually maybe getting into some of the things that even Wayne was looking at a little bit. So, I've actually called this the judgment of Israel. And I've aligned that with both Exodus and with Acts. And what am I trying to get at there? Well, I think a lot of times when we think of judgment, we think of this, you know, the judgments of God, it's almost like bad news, right? Like there's going to be destruction and vengeance and all of these things coming. And that's true. That's part of judgment. But there's also an aspect of this that involves the faithful being blessed. In other words, there's a blessing even within the judgment, and the judgment is dealing with the things that have to be dealt with, but God is, he has a purpose within that judgment that involves a blessing. And so what I want to look at is the parallels between a judgment that we see at the mountain in Exodus and the judgment that we see in Acts. Let's roll forward and think about that. So what are some points we see in this second arc of the story? Well, we see, at this point, we'll see the covenant written. In both cases, we'll see that there are some faithful that are blessed, and we'll see that there's some punishment for idolatry. So if you think about Paul in his writings, one of the big contrasts that he makes is the letter versus the spirit. And the letter particularly that was written in stone versus the spirit that was written in the heart. And that's one of those big, massive differences between the writing of the old covenant and the writing of the new covenant. So what happens right after this old covenant is written in stone for the first time up at the top of the mountain? Well, there's already some trouble in the camp, you know, down at the base of the mountain, and Moses comes down and he sees this idolatry and this whole situation playing out, and he actually, there's a judgment scene that starts to play out here. The key thing I want to pull out of that is that in this case, it was actually the letters of the law that were judging. So Moses, he broke the tablets. That was something that he did himself. But when he came down and delivered judgment at the camp, he was actually saying, this is the judgment of Jehovah, you know, that he's delivering. These are the words of Jehovah judging you. And the result ultimately was 3,000 killed in judgment there, at least in that first incident. If we fast forward then to Acts, and we think about, well, what happened? There was something sent down from above, but it wasn't the letter written in stone. We've got the Spirit, and it was sent down from Jehovah, from heaven, and you've got, like, the Spirit. This is Acts 2, you know, when they're preaching this word, and you have all of these signs and these things going on, the Spirit, like, pricks in the heart, and what can happen with that? Well, there were 3,000 saved by faith. In other words, the Spirit was judging and searching and convicting, and there was salvation instead of death delivered. So that's the writing of the covenants. Interesting similarities, big differences. But then I want to talk about, well, we're looking at this whole Acts period, and there's this judgment theme both in Exodus 32, where we have the golden calf scene, and the judgment that we see playing out during and at the end of Acts. What are some of the parallels there? Well, first and foremost, when Moses came down the mountain and he was seeing the idolatry and the dancing around the calf and all of that going on, there was this moment where he said, "Who's on the Lord's side?" And who was it who stepped up at that moment and said, "We are"? There was the tribe of Levi. So there was, within that whole disastrous scene, there was actually a faithful remnant, the tribe of Levi, who had not been a part of that idolatry at that moment, and they had faith in the words of Jehovah. They were faithful to God. And we see, again, the faithful in Acts are having faith towards Jesus Christ, the Messiah. They are acknowledging and believing, you know, starting at Acts 2 there and all of that playing out. And then there's a blessing that seems to be associated, even in that whole scene where there's judgment and things going amiss, there's a blessing. And you see it mentioned in Exodus 32 that Levi is special, that there's going to be a blessing coming. And then if we go later on through the books of Moses, we realize that Levi actually, that tribe, was then handled specially from then on. In other words, when they did the census in Numbers, Levi wasn't really counted with the nation. It's kind of like they're off in their own space. And eventually, of course, they were given special duties associated with the tabernacle and the service of God. So you've got a special thing happening with Levi, and I'm wondering if there are some alignments with that and the blessings of Abraham that are coming in the Acts period. You see, he's going back not to Moses, he's going back to the promises to Abraham, and these blessings are coming out on first the Jew, but also the Gentile. And why would that be interesting for something to do with the Levite? Well, I learned a little bit about the Levites in the study, and I think there's a lot more to dig out, but this is just what I could get in time for today. And the one thing that they were responsible for were these cities of refuge. And that was kind of one of those forgotten things in the Old Testament that I had forgotten about, is what's going on with these cities of refuge. So I want to look at that quickly here in Joshua. So this is in reference to the cities of refuge, and they were set up when Israel was put in the land. These were the cities appointed for all the children of Israel and for the stranger who dwelt among them, that whoever killed a person accidentally might flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stood before the congregation. Interesting. So do you know who was actually in charge of these cities? It was the Levites. They were actually kind of orchestrating and administering the cities of refuge. And not every Levite was actually a priest, right? The actual priests came out of Aaron and his descendants, but the Levites all had a special place with the tabernacle and the sanctuary and all of that. But there was, even within that, there was kind of like a selection of different roles for different people, is really what I'm trying to say. So the Levites were overseeing these cities of refuge, and I think that that could bring a whole new level of insight, perhaps, to some of the things we read, like, for example, in Hebrews chapter 6. I just want to turn there. Hebrews 6, 14 to 20, because here we have a few of these ideas all brought together in just a few verses. So Hebrews 6, 14 to 20. So we're actually going to see something about like a blessing of Abraham and a hint at a city of refuge. And I'll maybe start at verse 13. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation to them is an end of all strife. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath. But by two immutable things, in which it was impossible for God to lie, we have a strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us, which hope we have is an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil, whither the forerunner is for us entered in, even Jesus made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So there's actually a lot going on in those verses. I don't even understand all of that at this moment. But the key thing that really struck me was this idea of fleeing for refuge in a city of refuge during the Acts period. That's an interesting thing to think about. Why would we be talking about that? The other thing that's very neat about these cities of refuge is they were open both to the Jew, you know, to the Israelite, and to the stranger. So there were some different things going on in those cities that was maybe not the same as everywhere else. And they were specifically set out for someone who is involved in a crime accidentally, and, you know, maybe a crime of ignorance. Why would you be fleeing? Because there's some judgment coming. That would make a lot of sense. Why would you be fleeing for refuge? So we talked a little bit about blessing and refuge. Let's look at this punishment or this judgment theme now in the book of Acts. And they're both going to center around idolatry, as far as I can tell. And there's different ways we could look at this. But I see the key things in Exodus 32. We start out with a rejection of Moses. And by rejecting Moses, you know, the people, he had gone up into the mountain, and they're saying, we don't know what's happened to this guy. We're kind of giving up on him. That was also a rejection of Jehovah. That was a rejection of the God of Israel as much as his messenger. And what do you see happening at the camp? They're falling back into their Egyptian worship traditions. I don't know much about the calf, the golden calf, and all that stuff going on there, but I know there is a linkage between the worship traditions of Egypt and what was going on there. And I think even trying to understand, you know, how did Aaron set this up? How did he get to a point where he permitted this? There's a lot of stuff going on there. But the thing that stands out is this worship tradition from the world that they were supposed to be delivered from. And how does it end? The calf is burned and destroyed. It's boom, cast down. I submit to you that something very similar happened in the book of Acts. We've got a rejection of Jehovah himself. We have Christ saying to the religious leaders, you have made the words of God void because of your traditions. They're stuck in Jewish worship traditions this time instead of Egyptian ones, but they're still religions that are holding them back from Messiah. And then the punctuation mark on the judgment, the temple's burned and destroyed, just like the calf. And we saw Paul, he's talking about like a coming judgment, fleeing for refuge. Does Peter ever say anything like this? Well, here's what he says in Acts 3. For Moses truly said to the fathers, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear in all things, whatever he says to you. And it shall be that every soul who does not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. What is Peter talking about there? And could some of that actually have played out in that judgment at the end of Acts? So, that was a heavy section. We covered a lot of ground. And guess what? More judgment. So it's just how I happen to set it up, but I do promise there is grace and glory coming. You just have to hang on. So what do I want to pull out about this judgment? Because that kind of ended at a very dark place. It's almost depressing what happened there, right? And what happened in the storyline here is eventually, you know, there were a bunch of things that played out in Acts 32, but Moses goes back up the mountain, right? There's something happening up there. But this judgment here was very localized. This was Israel at the camp. They didn't even get out of camp, and they were judged right there. What we have happening next is way bigger in scope, right? You know, the judgment of the nations involves Israel now moving out of camp, and you got all this stuff going on. And I think it's really interesting to compare, in this case, Revelation to Numbers, Deuteronomy, in Joshua. And I think this is a landmark moment for me because I've never once taken Revelation into one of my studies. So it's a little scary. In the little bit that I've actually looked at Revelation, I've concluded something. It's actually a really hard and complicated book. No wonder there's so much confusion, right? Like, that book is hard. But I think one of the reasons it's hard is we maybe haven't gone to the 101 interpretation key, which is Moses, right? I mean, we're trying to understand Revelation. Yes, there's a lot of advanced prophets we've got to look at, but if we haven't learned the lesson of Moses, maybe we're just not going to put that book in its right place. So let's see what we can do with comparing Moses and the journey from Sinai or from the mountains into the promised land to what we're seeing in Revelation. And the key points I pulled out here are a covenant being established, a war in the wilderness, and then a great city falls. So I think those three things happen in both storylines, and there's just a striking similarity. So now we're starting to get closer and closer to this question of, well, when was the new covenant, you know, when did we really kick it off, if you will? And what's really interesting is something pretty cool happens the second time Moses goes up this mountain in the Old Testament, okay? We have the tablets of the testimony. We have the law re-given. It's engraved in stone again. But Moses has this amazing glory encounter with Jehovah. You know, his face is shining after he comes down the mountain. And there's this moment of real intercession between Moses and Jehovah. And what actually happens up there is you see, and you can read it in, basically in the second encounter in Exodus, one of these verses, it's just right around there. Jehovah actually says, after Moses pleads for Israel, Jehovah says, okay, you know, I'm going to do this now. He says, I'm making a covenant with you. So, and then of course Moses comes down the mountain, we get into Numbers, we have Israel numbered. This is like, here's the nation I'm going to take. So I think if there ever were a kickoff to the new covenant, maybe it looks a little bit like this kickoff of the old covenant that we saw, you know, the second time the tablets are given, Moses is glorified. We actually see this in Revelation. So Revelation starts out where? In heaven. John is up there in a vision. And what's actually being written? It's the testimony of Jesus Christ, right? And there's also these letters going out to the churches. But what we see is in heaven, the Son of Man glorified. You know, when Moses came down, his face was shining. People could hardly look at it. Well, here we have the Son of Man, his eyes of fire. People can't look at that. Very interesting. And then is there a numbering of Israel that happens in Revelation? If we get out to chapter 7, we have the 144,000. And it specifically lists the 12 tribes. So I think that's the nation of Israel there. We can't call those tribes something else. So I think that's perhaps a good place that we could say there's a kickoff moment. It doesn't mean that the kingdom is done or established, but things are really moving here once this happens. Because what happens after this? Well, the Lord says to Moses, you guys have been at camp long enough. You know, Deuteronomy, you gotta pack up, move into the wilderness, and take the promised land. Take your inheritance. Later on in Revelation, this is chapter 12, we actually see the woman in the wilderness. And if you read between the lines and you look at what they're talking about there, you can see that this woman is actually the seed of Israel. So there's a correlation there. In Deuteronomy, one of the big things we're seeing is the nation of Israel with Moses going across the wilderness and having battles with these various evil kings and nations that are kind of preventing them from getting into the promised land. And then in Revelation 13, we see war with the dragon and the beast. And there's like these 10 horns that kind of represent kings. Very interesting. But this still isn't, you know, we're still not in the promised land. We're in that journey across the wilderness. And we've had a lot of songs today. So I decided maybe we should just have a song right in the middle of a presentation. And we're not going to read it, but I do suggest that you look at the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. That it's a really cool read. And this is something that was given at the end of Moses' service, really. They're just finishing up, you know, all these battles with kings, but it's before they go into the promised land. And it's like God has given him a history of the nation before it happens almost. It's prophecy for Israel. And you'll see Paul and others quoting from the Song of Moses, you know, right through the Acts period when they're explaining things that are going on. And you'll then see in Revelation 15, this Song of Moses is sung one last time, almost like it's saying, you know what, everything that was in there, it's finished, all those last bits are there, and now we're singing a new song, the Song of the Lamb, and that's like the victory song of what's going to take you into the kingdom. So there's a song in both books there. I thought that was pretty cool. Moses and the Lamb. And then of course, and this is really hitting the high points, right? There's like, you could make a talk on every point just about on every slide here if you really wanted to. But how does the story end? A great city falls. On one hand, we've got Jericho, that's Joshua 6, and in Revelation, we've got Babylon, that's a great city, that falls. Just before that battle, Joshua actually sees the captain of the Lord's host, and that's Jehovah's army that's going to help them win against Jericho and the kings and the battles around there. In Revelation, we see the angel from heaven kind of setting the stage, you know, for the Lord's army that's going to help in this battle. In both cases, they're really, really wealthy cities. There's lots of, like, spoil inside, like great treasures, gold and silver and all of these things. And in both cases, the city falls and crumbles and is burned in judgment. And then it's not until after that that we're really getting into the promised land and kicking things off. So what I wanted to do, we've covered, there's a lot of ground there. I don't expect it to all make sense on the first pass. I think that there's a lot to look at. But I've learned a tremendous amount just kind of following the storyline of Moses and the children of Israel, right from where he teaches at Sinai out to the promised land, and comparing that to the teaching of Jesus all the way out to the end of Revelation. And I just wanted to put this on one diagram as a way to summarize this and just run through it quickly. So we started out, we had these three things, these three major arcs, the preaching to Israel, the judgment of Israel, which is at camp. Israel hasn't made it out of camp here. And then judgment of the nations. And the key things that we're lining up, well, we see Moses teaching, it's associated with a mountain. We see Jesus teaching, associated with a mountain. We see, in this case, there's the blood of animals, but there's the covenant blood shed. But we have the blood of Christ here. Then we see Moses ascends, Christ ascends, they disappear into a cloud. And in one case, the law is written, it's sent down the mountain, there's a judgment that happens. In another case, the Spirit's given, it's sent down from heaven, there's a judgment that happens. Judgments are not always a bad thing, right? There was the faithful that were blessed. We had the Levites here. We've got the faithful Jews and Gentiles blessed here. But then at the end, we've got the source of idolatry punished and burned, the calf burned, the temple burned. And of course, after that, Moses ascends, he gets the tablets again, and we see Moses is glorious after that. We see the Son of Man is glorious. We see Israel picks up, moves out into the wilderness. We see the woman in the wilderness in Revelation, and then we see the great cities fall, and then we're at the fulfillment of the kingdom. All of the layers have been built back up, and there's an inheritance in the promised land. So, looking at this just from a slightly different way, what are the rough divisions of how we might look at some of the books? So we've got the Exodus storyline really taking us right up to that second descent with Moses glorious, and then we've got Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua taking us into the promised land. And if we were to line this up on the top side, we've got the Gospels going up to the first descent, the Acts ending here. We've got to look at some of this stuff. But Revelation most definitely starts in heaven and ends on earth, which is interesting. So, the question is really, that's pretty interesting, but what is going on today, and how does that fit into this diagram, if at all? In other words, what's really happening? And if you look at Bible prophecy, one of the interesting things is a lot of people within Christianity, they look at Revelation, and because they see that there was this judgment back here, there's a tendency to say, well, maybe some of the stuff from Revelation actually happened back here. In other words, we're gonna pull some of this back in to AD 70, and maybe that's where that fits. But I think if we actually see, was there a judgment here that was prophesied? Was it prophecy being fulfilled? Yes. It wasn't Revelation, it was Moses, actually. I think what's going on here is actually pretty special. It's pretty focused on Israel, and there's something really unique that maybe I don't know that we fully understand what's going on here in the Acts period yet, but I think there's some good questions to ask. But if we see that, we can see, well, this actually finished. There was a finality about that judgment that was completed. So that's done. Well, are we starting to get into this judgment of the nations? Because that's another way that people look at it. They look at things that are happening today and say, well, maybe some of the trouble, some of the things that are happening in the world are a start of this. Well, at some point, that will be true. But I submit to you that if you actually have to ask the question, is God judging the earth right now? Like, has he come down in judgment? He's probably not doing it. If you have to ask that, if it's not obvious, and the reason I say that is if you look at what happened when Israel picked up camp and went into the wilderness, and they handed out the judgment of God on the wickedness that was around them, there was no question what was going on. Those nations around them, they saw that and they said, we don't know what's going on over there, but we know that your God has got something going on. And it was marvels that you could not deny. So when this kicks in place, it's just going to be a different world. That's all I can say. And I don't think we'll have to ask the question. Things will just, it will be there, manifest. So, the question I want to ask then is, what is going on in this mountain? And if you guys, actually I'll go here first. I want to get back there in a second. So what is going on in the mountain? And what I'd like to do, we have a few minutes still, so I think it'd be worthwhile, let's go back and actually read this passage in Exodus together, because Moses went up the mountain, and he came back down the mountain. Some really interesting stuff happened there. But if you remember our diagram here, here's Moses ascending. You'll notice I really couldn't find anything in the New Testament to line up with that, right? It was like, well, you know, Christ ascended up here. He's in heaven. He's glorified. He's coming back down. But I don't know about a second ascent. Is there one to line up there? So let's read Exodus. Exodus, we'll actually start in 33 because it's kind of important context for what actually happens in 34. And Moses had a really special request that he made of Jehovah here. So 33:19. Oh, there we go. I'm in the wrong place here, just a second. 33:19, and maybe I'll even go back to 18. So this is Moses making his request of the Lord. He says, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. Moses wants to see the glory of Jehovah. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And he said, thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock, and it shall come to pass, while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a clift of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away my hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. And the Lord said unto Moses, hew thee two tablets of stone like unto the first, and I will write upon these tablets the words that were in the first tablets which thou breakest. And be ready in the morning, and come up in the morning unto Mount Sinai, and present thyself there to me in the top of the mount, and no man shall come up with thee, neither let any man be seen throughout all the mount, neither let the flocks nor herds feed before that mount. And he hewed two tablets of stone, like unto the first, and Moses rose up early in the morning, and went up into Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him, and took in his hand the two tablets of stone. And the Lord descended in the cloud, and stood with him there, and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed by before him, and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering, and abundant in goodness and truth. And I guess I'll take it to 8. Keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. And Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. So, Moses has a pretty incredible glory moment here where he's in the presence of Jehovah up in the mountain, and then immediately after that, if you just continue down after 8, you'll see he's interceding for Israel, and then in verse 10, this is that defining covenant moment where Jehovah says, this is God saying it now, behold, I make a covenant before all thy people, I will do marvels, right? And then Moses goes down the mountain, packs up camp, and away they go. So this is a very interesting encounter that Moses has. And there's a second ascension here that he has. And so my question is there some type of special second ascension spoken of in the New Testament related to the work of Christ, right? Because as far as we can see back in the diagram, you know, he's, after preaching to Israel, he's up in heaven, and he's still in heaven, and then he comes eventually, not immediately, but later on in Revelation, he comes back down. So, I just want to direct your attention to Ephesians 4:8-10. And Paul's actually quoting a psalm here, but he's adding like another level to the psalm. And this is more of a question than anything. You know, what is really going on here? Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. So that's the statement from the psalm, and we could say perhaps a looking forward to that ascension of Christ and giving gifts that then came down in Acts. But there's actually a few things. There's different ways to translate this. There's receiving gifts for men. There's more to look at there. Now this, he ascended, what does it mean but that he also first descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens that he might fill all things. So the question is, are these two things the same? In other words, is Paul just explaining the first one in more detail, or is that actually a distinct second ascension of Christ? And let's put it on a diagram like this. So if we say, preaching to Israel, Christ ascends on high, and eventually judgment of Israel, but Christ is still on high. There's maybe gifts given or spirit sent down, different ways we could look at that. But then we have this second thing going on. Christ ascends far above all heavens. You know, is that just an extension of this? Was there a presence of Jehovah coming down during the Acts period and then going back up? I'm asking the question. I think there's some interesting things to look at there. But really, I want to draw your attention to the glory moment here, because I think just like there's this incredible glory moment tucked inside of the Old Testament, we've got this incredible glory moment tucked inside of the New Testament. And I just want to compare these two ascents, Moses in Exodus 34 to Christ in Ephesians 1 and 2. So in Exodus 34, what did we see? The mountain was cleared. You know, no one else could go up with Moses. There couldn't even be animals on it. So it was completely cleared, kind of like a symbol of something. This is special now. This is a holy space. And in Ephesians, we see this ascension associated with far above all things are under his feet. You know, nobody else is allowed there with Christ. And who's Moses in the presence of? Who are the two main actors in this scene? We have Moses in the presence of Jehovah, and in Ephesians, it's Christ at the right hand of the Father, right? So that's Jehovah at the Father's right hand. That's like the next level up, if you will. You have, you know, Moses and Jehovah, and then you've got Christ in the Father. That's about as high as it gets. Now, am I saying that what was going on there, you know, are we seeing the mystery revealed in Exodus? No, not at all. I don't think so. But there is a very interesting picture in parallel here. But we saw specifically that Moses had to be covered. He actually couldn't really see what was going on with that glory. When we come to Ephesians, Paul is praying that the eyes of our understanding would be enlightened to see. Nobody else was allowed with Moses, but in this case, we've been raised up together with and in Christ into the glory. And what does Moses experience? Really, grace, goodness, glory? There's the glory of Jehovah that he's just basking in up there at the top of the mountain. And in Ephesians, there's very much a similar theme, like this exceeding riches of grace and glory. So I think, I don't understand everything that's going on here, but I think there's a lot of interesting parallels and some key important differences that we can learn from here. So, just as a quick recap, what have we looked at? We talked about one way to look at right division that focuses more on, you know, the lines and the distinguishing and the differences, which is important, and it's true. And in that perspective, I think it's easy to fall in the trap of saying Old Testament, New Testament, but we're not studying them as a whole as much as we should. But we can then talk about right direction, which is using the Old Testament as a key to understanding the New Testament, lining them up, comparing these things seeing where that takes us. And I think that's a very scriptural principle. You know, Moses leading us to Christ. But then we saw that in the Old Testament, there's this amazing mountaintop glory moment that Moses himself gets to experience in the presence of Jehovah. Is there some type of a crazy explosion glory moment that happens at some point in that New Testament timeline that we get to experience? That's the question I want to leave you guys with. And the interesting thing about this is I believe that this is where we're sitting today. We're in this moment of this glory, and there's a lot of stuff around us that can distract us from this. You know, it's easy to, even within Christianity, it's easy to look at the judgments and the things that were playing out in Acts and try to fit things in there. I think a lot of people try to do that. We can also look to the future judgment in Revelation and try to pull things out of there and see if they fit to what's going on today. But wouldn't it be sad if, you know, we're distracted by all these other things happening, but we don't get to just bask in this glory that God has given to us, this amazing moment, this amazing, it's like a mountaintop experience we get to be in. And yeah, so I just wanted to leave you with that. And I think this is one of the reasons we study His Word, so that we can experience God and He can be a part of us. And the cool thing I think about is how do we know that we've experienced the grace and the glory and the riches of God? Well, when Moses came down from the mountain, he was glowing. And I think that when we're in that presence, we too can glow with the grace and the glory of God. And that's what He wants us to do today. That's our job today, is to glow. And yeah, there's some judgment coming, but that's a pretty cool thing to do right now. So I leave you with those thoughts. There's probably raised many more questions than I answered, which is good. So we'll talk more, but thank you.